Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ, along with Phil Latzman today. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, a serious accident still not yet in the clearing stages on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at Indian Bend, blocking the right lane, causing a pretty heavy backup there as well. Also a collision blocking the HOV lane, I-17 northbound at Greenway. We're expecting clear skies tonight around the valley. Overnight lows in the mid-50s, and we'll start to warm up tomorrow. Look for sunny skies with a high of 84. Currently with relative humidity at 10%, sunny and 76 degrees. An Arizona utility regulator has not one but two conflicts of interest. KJZZ's Will Stone reports Corporation Commissioner Andy Tobin was appointed earlier this year to replace Susan Bittersmith, who resigned over accusations that she violated conflict of interest rules.
After Governor Doug Ducey brought on Andy Tobin to serve out the final year of Bittersmith's term, it came out that Tobin's son-in-law works for Solar City, a major rooftop solar company with lots at stake in several rate cases in front of the commission. Now, it turns out Tobin has another conflict. His brother works on timing TV commercials for Cox. Commissioners oversee the telecommunications side of that company. Local attorney Tom Ryan, who filed the complaint against Tobin's predecessor for her involvement with Cox, says Tobin should resign immediately.
He has multiple conflicts of interest dealing with very important entities that he's ruling on and regulating. He's effectively precluded from ruling on any telecom issues and any electrical utility issues. This is just stunning to me.
But Tobin is making no indication he'll step down. In a statement, he points out that neither his son-in-law nor brother has managerial or budgetary authority, and that any conflict he has will be immediately disclosed. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona leaders are beginning to weigh in on the long wait times many Maricopa County voters experienced during the state's presidential primary this week. Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton has asked for a federal investigation into whether county elections officials illegally put fewer polling places in poor or minority-heavy areas in Tuesday's voting. And joining us now to discuss what he feels is disenfranchisement of Latino voters is David Adame, who's president and CEO of Chicanos por la Causa. David, how were Latino voters affected directly by this week's voting issues?
Well, specifically, it's very frustrating because I think Latino voters are very motivated to vote based on, you know, some of the interesting dialogue going on with the presidential candidates during the debates and then some of the statements being made. And to have the areas specifically that are high concentrations of Latino or Hispanic voters have less polling places compared to Anglo-dominated cities like Fountain Hills, Paradise Valley, and Peoria, you know, to try to go vote. First of all, most of them are blue-collar, right? And you get for law, you're supposed to get some time off, but you can't wait in line, you know, 2-3 hours and then try to go back to work. And then combine that with trying to throw in daycare and other things. I think it was just very, very, very unfortunate and unfair and frustrating for, you know, the Latino community.
Do you feel that this was intentionally done?
You know, the cynical part of me would say that better planning and more support for the community should have been put in hand. They know that voter turnout across the country has been at record levels. And to go from the number of polling places down to, I think it was almost half the number of voting places, to me, there's something there that doesn't make logical sense why you would reduce it.
Do you have faith in leaders in Arizona to fix this problem?
I'm an optimistic person, so I have hope and faith that they're going to do that. But, you know, I know Helen Purcell, the latest article I saw, that she, you know, she's pointing the finger at her and there's calls for her to resign. Rather than, you know, say I take the blame, tell me what you're going to do about it. Tell me what you're going to do to fix the problem that has been going on. And you can't tell me that you couldn't have anticipated this much, much better. So I just hope and believe that our leaders, and if not, that's why we need to get even more civically engaged so that we can put leaders in there that are making sure that all of their constituencies are being provided the fair access to, especially this biggest right you have as a citizen of the United States to vote.
David Adame is president and CEO of Chicanos por la Causa. David, thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Some observers say another factor that complicated Tuesday's voting and added to those hours-long lines at polling places is that fewer Arizonans than expected mailed in their ballots early. So are fewer people interested in voting by mail? To learn more, I'm joined by Paul Gronke. He's a political science professor at Reed College in Oregon and founder and director of the Early Voting Information Center. Paul, what early voting trends are you seeing? Is there a certain percentage of people who are simply not interested in voting early?
There has been growing levels of early voting nationwide, really over the past quarter century. Arizona has actually been one of the early innovators, and they have fairly high levels of early voting. There is always a percentage of individuals when you have a system that allows for precinct-based voting and early voting. There's a percentage that choose to wait until Election Day, and a lot of this varies by states. It's as small as a third in a lot of western states. A lot of the East Coast states and Southeast, like Florida, they have early in-person voting and no-excuse absentee, yet still one-third of the electorate wants to come and show up on Election Day.
There were a number of people, tens of thousands of people, actually, who cast a vote for Marco Rubio. And then between that time and the time of the actual Election Day here in Arizona, he had dropped out of the race. And so that made some people wonder if there should be tweaks, or is that on the voter to just wait until closer to Election Day to cast the vote?
Well, there is a tweak. It's a little bit more than a tweak. It's fairly significant, but there's two things that could be done. There is the opportunity or possibility that you could cast a second ballot if the system was set up to make sure that you could check those two ballots. So that would be called the regret ballot, that you'd show up on Election Day if you voted earlier. But you'd have to have a very careful system set up so that the first ballot would then not be counted, would be removed, and the second ballot would be counted. Another system that may seem a little bit radical, but it's used in a number of municipalities. It's used for a lot of votes that people vote for kind of corporate governance boards. It's used for the Oscars, is to allow people in a primary to do ranked choice voting, where you'd vote for your top candidate, but you could vote for your second choice and your third choice. Then if a candidate drops out, say Marco Rubio is your top choice, and let's say John Kasich, for example, was your second choice. If Rubio drops out, then you could count the second choices rather than the first choices.
I didn't expect to ask you about the Postal Service, but I will. There were some surprises. Some people I know who I think are pretty well-connected when it comes to politics, they were surprised that they would not have been able to put the early ballot in the mail as close to Election Day as they had initially thought. And I don't know, are there certain rules out there and that certain states use based on whether the ballot can be postmarked by a certain date or whether it actually has to arrive to the county recorder's office?
So what we call that is postmarked date ballot. And there are a number of states, Alaska, California has just changed this law, Washington State, that the ballot only needs to be postmarked by Election Day. It does not need to be delivered by Election Day. Oregon, on the other hand, the first state to go full vote by mail, does require that your ballot arrive at the election office on Election Day. And what's required in a system like this really is good partnership between election officials and the Postal Service, and frankly, a well-funded Postal Service with good, reliable workers. That differs state by state. It's not in every state that you can actually hire and hold good people for the Postal Service and get this kind of partnership between election officials and the Postal Service. So one solution would be to go this postmark system where the ballot just needs to be postmarked. The problem with that is media folks like you, Steve, are going to be unhappy, and candidates,
right,
because you won't get the full results on election night. You'll have to wait 3 or 4 days, 5 days, maybe a week even, until all those ballots come in and all those ballots are counted.
Reed College political science professor Paul Gronke, he's also founder and director of the Early Voting Information Center. Paul, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Phil Latzman. As spring training comes to a close, the baseball world is mourning the loss of one of its most beloved figures.
Yeah, longtime Valley resident and Hall of Famer Joe Garagiola Sr. passed away yesterday at the age of 90. Known as one of the sport's great ambassadors, Garagiola grew up in St. Louis and started his career as a player with his hometown Cardinals. In 1946, he won a World Series there. He played 9 seasons as a catcher for 4 different major league teams, and he never lost his passion for the game.
I love baseball the way it is. I'll paraphrase Will Rogers. I never saw a baseball game I didn't like.
But his talents were better put to use in the broadcast booth, where he would eventually become an instant hit as one of the game's most natural announcers, glib, insightful, and self-deprecating.
The first job I had, I worked with Harry Carey. There's an experience. But he was a great broadcaster in St. Louis, and he was the one that encouraged me. And then I graduated to working with guys like Kurt Gowdy, Lindsey Nelson, Vince Scully.
This is Joe making fun of his own baldness from a 1984 NBC Game of the Week.
Hi, everybody. I'm Vince Scully, along with Joe Garagiola, the windy city in Chicago. And what a great way to break the seal on 1984.
Break the seal is right. If you're sitting in the stands and you got an infield like mine, you better get that sucker covered, I'll tell you that.
Eventually, he would make his way to Arizona with his son, Joe Garagiola Jr., who became the Diamondbacks' first general manager. Joe Sr. served as team broadcaster from 1998 until his retirement in 2013. Diamondbacks president Derek Hall says the team was lucky to have him as part of their young history.
He's been family, that's for sure, not only for me, but the entire organization. And when you think back to the history of this man, what he's meant to baseball, the history that he had with other teams, for him to consider us his team, his hometown team, and of course he was a broadcaster here, but what a career. He's synonymous with baseball. He's one of the characters. We lost a big one today.
And last year, following the death of his lifetime friend Yogi Berra, who grew up with him basically just next door in St. Louis, I spoke with Joe's son, Joe Jr., about the unique connection his dad had with the fellow Hall of Famer.
Who in life is fortunate enough to live to that age and to have somebody that constant in your life that, I mean, they spoke every couple of weeks. And they were born in the 20s.
And Steve, also just like Yogi, Joe G became even more well-known outside of the sports world.
This is Today with Bryant Gumbel, Deborah Norville, and Joe Garagiola.
And good morning. Welcome to Today on a very special Monday morning, one in which we are welcoming several new members, including a gentleman who's back here after a 17-year absence. How you been? Where have you been?
Oh, great, man. I was just sleeping my life away. I used to sleep till 6, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Now here I am. This morning.
Oh, great. Like doing the 5 o'clock mass again. Here I am, you know.
Especially in the 1970s, Joe Garagiola was a staple on major television shows in the U.S. at a time when the landscape was dominated by 3 networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. Garagiola co-hosted the Today Show for several seasons and filled in as host of the Tonight Show for the king of late night, Johnny Carson. He also hosted and guested on game shows of the era. To put it in perspective, I'm joined by TV historian Robert Thompson of Syracuse University. How big a deal was Joe Garagiola in the 1970s?
Joe Garagiola was a household name. I mean, this guy was a very, very familiar face. Now, we have to remember a couple of things. Back then, before cable had really kicked in, depending on what city you lived in, you might have 8 channels to choose from. You might have 3 channels to choose from. But most people, 90% of the population, were usually watching ABC, NBC, or CBS. So there was a sense that there was a lot less TV back then, and we were all kind of seeing the same thing at the same time. The reason, I think, if you are younger than a certain age that you may never even have heard of Joe Garagiola, is that the work that he did, which was a big deal back when he was doing it, is not the kind of stuff that goes into syndication. So even though Lucille Ball has been gone for lo these many years, everybody still stumbled upon a rerun of I Love Lucy. And that same is true of lots of other dramas and sitcoms and all the rest of it. Garagiola did his work as his big work, of course, on sports, doing baseball games, and then he would substitute host for the Tonight Show, and he hosted the Today Show. He had 2 different chunks of time he did that, and then he would do game shows.
He had a number of memorable nights as substitute host of the Tonight Show, but one really stands out for you, right?
In 1968, it was May. And he was substitute hosting along with Tallulah Bankhead, another person that if you're older, not old enough, won't know the name of. But Garagiola is substitute hosting The Tonight Show. And a live interview with Paul McCartney and John Lennon. This is 1968. And it's a 22-minute long interview. It doesn't exist anymore. There's an audio version of it, and there's a transcript, but the video doesn't exist. And it's really interesting. This is one of the few times we've seen those two together on a live interview. And, of course, they seem to be a little out of sorts that John starts by saying, "How are you, Johnny?" Paul says, "Where's Johnny?" I mean, there's a sense that I think they were expecting Carson, and they got Joe. But he has some really interesting moments with them. He asks them if they think they're ever going to be able to top Sergeant Pepper. A pretty good question. And he also has a really interesting bit with John, who you know, says he's nervous because the whole thing is, this is so artificial. The notion of having a conversation in front of millions of people is not a normal thing to do.
Ultimately, what do you think made Garagiola a popular choice for all of those mainstream TV shows?
He had that real friendly sort of way about him. And of all the people on TV, this guy looked more like a regular Joe than about anybody I can think of. The smiley face, the big face, the bald head. He didn't look like Central Casting had sent him down.
Robert Thompson is director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. We've been talking about the broadcasting career of the late Joe Garagiola. The families of the seriously mentally ill often find themselves trapped in a cycle of homelessness, hospitalizations, and medications. But the challenge of finding appropriate places for the seriously mentally ill to live is community-wide. A recent study from ASU's College of Public Service and Community Solutions found that people within the system say limited housing for people with mental illness is the most pressing problem it faces. The show's Lauren Gilger talked to one Valley mother to find out why.
Every time the phone rings, you think that that's what you're going to hear, that they found him somewhere.
Last January, Sherry Van Sant's son disappeared for a month.
He would go through all of his money in a week. And then he would be in and out of homeless shelters or, you know, sleeping outside, digging in garbage cans, trying to find food, begging for food.
He's 39 years old and has been battling with mental illness since he was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 21. This wasn't the first, or she fears, the last time he would disappear.
And then he would just get so desperate that he eventually will call us.
He's under a court order for treatment, which requires him by law to take medication for his mental illness. But Van Sant says for almost a decade, he's been stuck in a destructive pattern.
We started this back and forth. You know, he'd go off of his meds, he'd get really, really sick.
She asked us not to use her son's name in this story to protect his privacy.
Each time he would go off and then come back on, He didn't come quite back to his baseline. Each time he would get a little bit sicker.
And one of the biggest challenges has always been finding him an appropriate place to live, she says.
We worked and worked and worked to try to get him into a living situation where he would have more supervision and get some counseling and that they would see that he stayed on his medications, but there wasn't anything available.
At one point, things got so bad, he checked himself into the hospital and asked for help. He wanted to go into a group home, but again,
there was not a bed available for him to go to.
How many times did you hear there's no bed available?
Oh, gosh, I think we started asking for that in May, and every week, there's no bed, there's no bed, there's no bed. Dozens of times we heard there's no bed available.
It took 7 years on a Section 8 waiting list, but in 2012, her son got an apartment of his own, as well as an assertive community treatment, or ACT, team, dedicated to keeping him on his medications and helping him become functional. But Van Sant says having a place to live only helps so much.
It keeps you off the street, but when a person is delusional and they think that the place they live is unsafe, then they're going to leave. And that's what my son does when he's not well.
We definitely need more 24-hour supervised group homes, and we need good ones.
State Senator Nancy Bartow spent much of last summer learning about the challenges facing the seriously mentally ill in Arizona. She says the state will spend more than $600 million on mental health services in 2017.
That doesn't even take into account what we're spending in the ERs, through access, or in the prison system.
The state spends an estimated $16 million on behavioral health in state-run prisons. And Bartow says we need to be smarter about where those dollars go.
I think we're spending our funding in the wrong places.
Funding for housing for the seriously mentally ill has increased in recent years, but not by enough, according to Tad Gary, chief clinical officer with Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care, the regional behavioral health authority in Maricopa County. He says without supported housing and the services that come with it, it's very hard to keep patients on track.
It's very difficult to provide someone their physical health care, you know, to manage their diabetes when at night they're going to a shelter.
And that's a community problem, according to Blythe Fitzharris, who oversees outpatient services for adults with serious mental illness at Mercy Maricopa.
It's not a challenge that Maricopa alone experiences. It's nationwide.
Fitzharris says Mercy Maricopa has put 3,000 seriously mentally ill people in subsidized housing and wrapped intensive services around them to keep them there.
The evidence shows the success. The evidence shows success with folks that have a chronic mental illness.
They can expand those services because they're Medicaid covered, but housing subsidies are not. So without more funding, Gary says they can't provide all the housing that's needed.
We absolutely need more state and federal dollars pulled down, brought to the subsidies, to increase subsidies within our county.
And that's not likely to happen in Arizona, at least in the near future. The state allocated more than $16 million for supported housing in 2016, and Senator Bartow says legislators probably can't add more right now.
You know, we live with heartbreak every day of our lives. Always. We're always worried about him.
Vincent says her son has been doing well for the last 3 months, and she's hopeful for the first time in a long time that he may break the pattern.
How come you haven't given up?
Because he's my son, and you just don't give up on people that you love.
Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
Edward Snowden changed the way the world looks at privacy. In 2013, the former NSA contractor shared classified information about government data collection with journalist Glenn Greenwald, who won a Pulitzer Prize for the Guardian newspaper with his reporting on the leaks. Greenwald is giving a talk on privacy at the University of Arizona tomorrow, and KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins had a chance to speak with him. Jimmy, what did you learn?
Well, we spoke about how the public's conception of privacy has changed since the initial leak. Greenwald founded a news outlet called The Intercept that reports on the Snowden documents over time, you know, to really dig into this massive surveillance program that was uncovered. And he told me it's this gradual reporting that has kept public interest alive.
Prior to these revelations, people, I think, just tacitly assumed that what they were doing on the internet was more or less safe. They had no idea that there had been this massive state apparatus created in the dark, designed overwhelmingly to ensure that nothing that they do or say on the internet is beyond the reach of surveillance. And I think one of the most valuable parts of what these revelations have accomplished is it has caused people around the world to think about what privacy means in the digital age. And the fact that we now do so much online as part of our lives, that it is really crucial to reflect on what it would mean if everything that we're doing is subject to monitoring and surveillance, and what it would mean to sort of the essential parts of human freedom that privacy guarantees.
Do you think we have, in a sense, lost the sanctity of privacy? We seem to be so frivolous with our data. Does that make it harder to bring about strong privacy protections?
Human nature is very complicated, and part of human nature is that we're social animals, which means we do have a desire for other people to know what we're doing, to see what we're doing, to sort of act in public in a way that other people are able to know about. And that explains why, for example, we put so much of our lives online voluntarily. We use Facebook and other social media to reveal parts of our lives that probably even 20 years ago or 30 years ago would have been regarded as private. So in that sense, I think there has been this erosion. But at the same time, equally essential to what it means to be a free human being is that we all seek out places to be able to go where nobody can watch what we're doing. We put passwords on our email accounts. We put locks and we use locks on our bedroom and bathroom doors. So I think this desire to have a place where you can go, where you're essentially left alone, where you're not being watched and monitored, is an inherent part of human freedom. And although the internet has enabled a lot more sharing, when it's voluntary, there's nothing wrong with that. What becomes problematic is when there's an involuntary invasion into the parts of our lives that we actually want to keep private. And I think that's what we've seen so much of over the past couple of years.
What are your thoughts on the case between Apple and the FBI? What do you think is the proper balance between public safety and privacy?
I think that traditionally the division has been pretty clearly established, which is that if the government can demonstrate to a court that there's a reason to believe that somebody is involved in criminality, the court will issue a search warrant and allow a search of that very specific person. The problem is that what they've actually been doing is mass surveillance, subjecting hundreds of millions of people who have done nothing wrong to very invasive forms of scrutiny by storing and collecting, and then when they want, analyzing whatever it is they're doing on the internet with no search warrant or even any suspicion of any kind. I think the FBI Apple case represents this conflict in the sense that what the government is saying is that you can never say anything or do anything that is inaccessible to our prying eyes. And that's essentially what they're saying in the Apple case. Apple is saying that there's no way to give you, the government, access to these communications of our users without compromising basic protections. It would mean that if we create a backdoor for you, hackers and other governments around the world, terrorists or anyone else, will be able to access it. And the government is saying this is unacceptable because there can never be communications off limits to us. And as a society, that's something we've never accepted before.
Many of the entities holding vast amounts of our data are multinational corporations. So even if we develop good privacy policy in the United States or in other countries, does that matter?
I think it matters for a couple of reasons. It is true that the data collection and surveillance being done by private corporations, especially these massive global giants that have no accountability, like Google and Facebook, presents really serious problems. But those problems are of a different nature than when the state is engaged in a system of mass surveillance for two reasons. Number one is, if you do a chat on Facebook or send an email through Gmail, Google will have your email, Facebook will have your chat, but it won't have all of your internet communications. It will only have the communications and activities that you do through that particular company. In contrast, when the US government is collecting everything, all of your information is centralized in one place, which makes it much more pernicious. The second part of it is if you look at the Bill of Rights limits the power of government, but not the power of private actors and corporations, for one very simple reason, which is that the government has all kinds of powers that nobody else has. And so there's a particular kind of danger that is presented when the government that exercises these vast amounts of power is able to invade your privacy. And most historical examples of surveillance abuses have come from the state.
And Steve, Greenwald thinks the government is going to continue to focus on encryption. He thinks they'll continue to fight for backdoor access to encryption programs, and tech companies and privacy activists will continue this pushback. The privacy discussion is tomorrow at the U of A. Greenwald is going to be joined on stage with linguist and political activist Noam Chomsky, and Edward Snowden himself will be calling in from an undisclosed location. So some really heavy hitters in the world of privacy.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, I'm Annette Crocked, and I'm at flyball practice.
Get your ball!
Jump! Flyball is a relay race dog sport.
We'll see Tammy. Go get her! Go!
The dogs jump over four hurdles, get a ball out of a spring-loaded box, and race back as fast as they can. And the next dog goes and all happens in about 20 seconds.
Good boy. Chloe, look, get your ball, get it. Good girl.
So I got into it because I had a border collie puppy who had a bunch of energy and needed some stimulation for his brain so he didn't destroy my house.
Get it.
He doesn't need shoes anymore, he doesn't need pillows, he's pretty good.
That's Annette Kroc practicing with the Barkin Bandits flyball team in Ahwatukee. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we deserve a treat, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. In KJZZ News at 2:38, after 65 months, Arizona has fully recovered all the jobs lost during the Great Recession. That's according to the Arizona Department of Administration, which says the state experienced 35 straight months of job losses, 10 months more than the U.S. overall. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports.
The Department of Administration says the state's total workforce reached a new high of 2.7 million last month. The leisure and hospitality sector has regained nearly double the jobs lost since the recession. Looking forward, the state projects Arizona jobs will grow by nearly 3% through the first half of next year.
21% of Arizona employees right now are considering making a move.
Phoenix recruiting manager Michael Fitzgerald says he's seeing more passive job seekers.
Passive candidates are not necessarily unsatisfied with their current employment, but realize that there may be opportunities for them to improve their current situation.
According to state projections, the largest number of new jobs will be in professional and business services, while the largest percentage gain will be in construction. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show for Thursday, March 24th. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. If there's an exhilaration that comes from seeing new bridges, shiny clean airports and transportation hubs, there's also a demoralization that comes from city facilities that are falling down, in disrepair that says no money, no vision, help is not on the way. America's crumbling infrastructure comes out of the tap water in Flint, Michigan, or you can see it in the aging facilities in Cincinnati, Newark, Boston, Los Angeles, the list goes on. Not even the presidential candidates are shying away from this one.
We are crumbling.
We can't figure out what to do with our infrastructure.
There's no reason the federal government should be in the business of deciding what roads and bridges to build in the state of New Hampshire.
To fix our roads, our bridges.
We need a major investment to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure.
But not much actually gets done. And where it does get done, people are smiling, but nationally, not much of a policy. What's the problem here? Philip K. Howard is chair and founder of Common Good, a nonpartisan reform coalition which seeks to bring common sense to government. Now, you know, I hate to bring this up, but I just happened to have traveled to Australia. I went from JFK to LAX to Brisbane Airport. And I have to say, you know, as prosperous as we are here in the United States, I mean, compared to Australia, and I've also had the same experience traveling in Europe, I mean, the United States is a dump, I mean, in so many ways.
Well, it is a dump. The problem actually is not money. Infrastructure, most infrastructure projects pay for themselves. Studies of this, you can finance them. There are all kinds of private partner, public partnerships now that can finance these things. The problem is that we have so much process, ironically, so much environmental review that we can't do projects that are good for the environment. So we need to get our act together.
That's the vision piece. In Flint, there's also a safety and danger piece here. Talk about that for a little bit.
Well, Flint involved a number of problems. First of all, it was an operational tragedy. Somebody decides to save money by changing the water source. They didn't understand that the old pipes would react badly to the new water without certain chemicals. They actually had notice over a year ago that the water was a problem, but the state's Department of Environmental Quality said, oh, it's just an isolated incident, and didn't do what would be obvious, which is to actually test the water around town. Finally, some university tested it and realized a few months later and realized that this was actually, tragically, almost killing people. So that was an operational problem, but it stemmed from the fact that they had an ancient water system that nobody understood.
America's infrastructure was built, you know, at the end of the Gilded Age and in the industrial sort of peak of the 20th century, when there was huge surplus, huge wealth surplus from the rising industrial economy. And that seems to be the case in China, where there is huge surplus, excess growth, and they can make these investments relatively painlessly. Other countries seem to be able to do it without that surplus. Why do we require it to be such a gold rush before we do anything?
Yeah, you know, it's not a money problem here. We've been studying a new tunnel under the Hudson River. It's going to cost $20 billion. And we're going to do a forum in a few weeks on this. We have to have this new tunnel. If we don't have the tunnel, one of the old tunnels, because it's been damaged, 100 years old, will have to close down, and it will be an environmental disaster. The traffic jams, the capacities go down 75%. You know, it's going to be really bad. If we could approve that tunnel so the shovels can be in the ground next year, 2017, which is realistic, it will cost about 25% less and would be better for the environment. But no one at the moment has the authority to do that. So I was down in Washington recently talking with the White House about this. You know, we need an executive order just to do what's obvious, to get the shovel in the ground.
Finally, because I just love asking this question, bullet trains in my lifetime, please. Mr. Howard, please, please, Santa.
Absolutely. If someone can actually have the authority to do what was done 100 years ago, which is you're going to have to condemn some land, you're going to have to create new tracks that go straight between, you know, Boston and New York and Washington. And to do that, some people will have to move and will have to pay for that. And we can go from Boston to Washington in 2 hours.
Or Chicago, St. Louis.
Absolutely.
Right. All St. Louis, things. Denver. I
mean. All those things. But we have to be committed to making choices that actually affect some people for the greater good. And that's kind of what government's about. But we've created such a kind of a jungle of red tape around each project that literally no one is in charge.
Philip K. Howard is chair and founder of Common Good, a nonpartisan reform coalition which seeks to bring common sense to government spending. Philip, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Phoenix's music scene has struggled to reach its full potential over the years. At one time, people said it could be the next Austin or Seattle. But as music venues closed and the scene became more spread out, it seemed to fracture. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry was in Austin last week for the South by Southwest Music Festival and discovered an organization called How to Build a Music City. Based in Columbus, Ohio, its goal is to build up the value of music in cities. This week, Sarah spoke with the organization's founder, Joey Hendrickson. Hi, Sarah. So what did you learn?
Well, Hendrickson founded the Columbus Songwriters Association and started hearing from musicians. Those conversations got bigger and more organized, and How to Build a Music City came out of it. So I asked him, what makes a music city?
It's a question that I think a lot of musicians should be asking, is how do we build up our music environment together? At the same time, I think it's a question that business leaders should be asking in a city and city officials should be asking as well. And I think a music city is one that has a lot of sustainability around an economic environment for music, which has to do with jobs. It has to do with the social environment. And it has to do with the cultural environment as well. So for me, that's kind of where it stands. It's an economic environment where music creates jobs and opportunities for everybody.
So how do you begin to structure something like that? Because I think about, for example, a city like Phoenix, which is known for having certain types of industries. I guess, how do you begin to sort of think about shifting or creating new economic opportunities around the music industry in a city?
One way is to look at what other cities have done, and you look at some of the programs that already exist, and then you bring your community together and you decide what the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats are in your city, and then start to build around the strengths. At least in Columbus, that's what we've done so far. And it seems to be getting the rest of our city's interests so that we can have funding that supports the programming and then creates impact. Seattle has an amazing program that focuses on their airport and programming around performances for musicians. Toronto took, you know, more of a music meets film approach because of the film culture in Toronto. And then they've also done a plethora of other programs that have just provided so many opportunities to musicians in both of those cities.
Can you give some kind of examples of maybe what you did in Ohio, which may have like a more similar arts climate to somewhere like Phoenix than perhaps Austin or Toronto?
So in Columbus, we identify one of our strengths as music festivals. We have over 100 festivals in our city, and we just love music festivals. And so when considering our strengths as a city, we looked at music festivals. We thought about what programming can we provide music festivals to create next level value for musicians living in our city. And one of those program ideas is bringing in music supervisors and then also other people in the music industry who can create opportunities for musicians and basically funding showcases within the festivals that appeal to those specific people in the music industry. So if you're placing music for a film, you might be looking for something fresh. Our commission is going to create a program where we can attract music supervisors to Columbus to hear some of the most up-and-coming music, and then create those relationships between the artists and the music supervisors so that Columbus-based musicians get licensing placements in a TV and film.
So this is a little bit interesting, because I think maybe when you hear the term Music City, the initial thing that comes to mind is sort of like a really vibrant city that's known for its music culture, where you can kind of go to a bunch of different shows on any given night. It actually sounds like maybe part of the way you're thinking of it is not so much in terms of making it the same kind of a music city as a New York or an LA or an Austin, but figuring out what works for your city and ways to make music more of an economic industry. Is that right?
Absolutely. The term Music City is such it's a loose, multicolored term. You know, it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. For us in Columbus, the mission of our music commission is to attract endless opportunities for the Columbus music community. And that's really all, I think once we've created opportunities, that's when we have become the music city that we want to be. When our musicians are getting paid, when our venues are finding sustainable resources, and then when our city is coming around music, I think we can live up to our status as a music city.
Joey Hendrickson, founder of How to Build a Music City.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
There's a new plan to help stop the decline in the number of African elephants by cracking down on the trafficking routes used by poachers. 40 global transport companies have pledged to prevent poachers from moving their kill. Southern Tanzania has lost more than 60% of its elephant population in the last 5 years, and in Central Africa, the figures are worse. The BBC's Alistair Leith had traveled to a national park in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where protecting elephants appears to be more like war than conservation.
Well, it's very early in the morning. The sun's just come up, and we're on the back of a deployment vehicle, as they call it. There are six of the rangers here, all armed, and we're heading about 3 or 4 hours through the park north for them to deploy on one of their 9-day operations where they live out in the bush and they watch out for poachers. Well, we stopped by the road and we're now heading to the site of where 5 elephants were killed. It's about 3 or 4 kilometers from here. Well, we've come through the long grass into a clearing and seen the first elephant that was killed about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's quite small, very badly decomposed. Obviously, it's been eaten by vultures. Just a few meters away is another one. Now, this is a bigger elephant, and you can see the front, its face, where obviously the tusks were taken from. It smells terrible. And then just another 10 meters up here is another one.
One of the rangers who found the carcasses described how they followed the poachers' footprints but lost the trail, and they'd had a 3-day head start. Only 100 rangers to secure thousands of square kilometers of long grass savanna. A small plane is the best way to see the extent of Garamba, one of Africa's first national parks and a World Heritage Site, originally set up to protect the northern white rhino. But that has already been wiped out by poachers. Now they're fighting to save their elephants. There are perhaps 1,300 left here. There used to be 22,000. Training drills start at sunrise. The group running Garamba, African Parks, have brought in South African trainers like Basil to help the rangers improve.
So we trained them and we have improved them by about 300%, I would say. Easy. And the main thing is the shooting, you know, to teach them how to shoot properly, the correct way. And then also a little bit of tactics in the bush, what to do, what to look for. They must become better than the poachers in order to catch them.
But the weapons are old. Few rangers hit even a close target.
Training
takes a lot of time and money, and the men they're up against are hardened fighters. Chrysostom Agare Adraba is a ranger who's 38. He described his worst clash with poachers. His friend died. They were ambushed by a group of 40, all on horseback, probably from Sudan, heavily armed with grenades and rockets. Four of the Rangers were killed, and the rescue helicopter was almost shot out of the sky.
I think Garamba is probably today the forefront of conservation in terms of dangers. I just don't think there are many other places which has so much contact and so many threats to one park as we have here.
Eric Morau from African Parks manages Garamba. There are a few tourists, so most of his funding comes from the EU or from philanthropists. His list of poachers includes armed groups spilling over from the border in South Sudan's civil war, Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army, those Sudanese horsemen and locals.
It's worth so much more than just animals. It's about trying to stabilize a whole region. And that is why we wake up every morning, why everybody fights this war, and why we try and save the elephants. It's about basically saving Congo.
Suddenly, more elephants were reported killed. So again, we took to the air.
And there are the carcasses, just down there by the river. Five of them, one of them a baby. And there's six we've just spotted a little bit further up the river from there. It's hard to make out from up here, but you can see that their faces have been cut off, that the tusks have been taken.
They need hundreds more rangers to protect Garamba. On the front line of the poaching war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the elephants are fast disappearing.
That's the BBC's Alistair Leithhead. The Easter holiday is coming up this weekend. At the very mention of Easter or spring, you may start thinking about bunnies, ducklings, and chicks. Those symbols of the holiday are sometimes even given as Easter gifts. The show's Annika Klein tells us the problem starts when people decide they don't want their gifts anymore.
The Riparian Preserve in Gilbert is the perfect place to watch ducks. Most of the ducks here are mallards, with deep green heads or speckled brown wings. But one duck on the lake today stands out. It's white all over, with a tuft of feathers on its head. It looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, but it's not a wild duck.
There's only one kind of waterfowl duck we should see out there, and that's our migratory mallard. So if you see a big old white duck, that's someone's pet, that's someone's farm duck.
Lisa Limbert is with East Valley Wildlife, a wildlife rehab group. But every year, the volunteers find themselves roped into rescuing domestic animals that were released into the wild.
You want to get out?
Today, Limbert is teaching a group of fourth graders at the Riparian Preserve. They get to pet Puddles the duck and Frosty the rabbit.
This is a new breed of domestic rabbit. It's called a lion head. Look at all that hair!
Frosty is missing an eye. He was released into the wild and didn't do too well. Limbert says people think small pets intuitively know how to survive on their own.
It would just be like dropping us off in the woods. I mean, maybe there is edible stuff out there, but we don't know how to identify it. He doesn't either.
Gilbert Parks and Recreation bans the release of domestic animals in a park or preserve. But it still happens, and Limbert says the release of ducks and bunnies springs upward a couple months after Easter. Kim Desilon with Brambley Hedge Bunny Rescue can second that.
It's kind of a cycle every single year, and we do tend to see more rabbits homeless or found as strays around May or June.
The Bunny Rescue holds adoptions every week, except the week of Easter. Desilon says they worry people are interested in an impulse holiday buy rather than an eight-year-plus commitment. Then overflowing rescues like Brambley can't handle all the intake requests, and the county shelter doesn't take farm animals. So some end up in the parks. But that doesn't mean they're taken care of by the state. Linda Lambert is with Arizona Game and Fish.
If we've got, you know, wildlife officers out and they see, you know, a domestic duck hanging out with ducks on a pond at the golf course, we don't do anything with it.
As long as the ducks and bunnies aren't competing with the native species, she says, they leave them alone. But then it's East Valley Wildlife that may get the call if one of those animals is injured. Lisa Limbert says it's frustrating.
We're spending an awful lot of time rehoming, treating, absorbing our precious resources, taking care of people's discarded pets. And that affects the wildlife that we're truly set up and licensed to help. And that's really disappointing.
So East Valley Wildlife and bunny rescues like Brambley Hedge use the Easter holiday as an opportunity to try to educate people.
I want to take the other one.
Limbert says it's fine if a family does want to adopt a Puddles or a Frosty, as long as they've got their ducks in a row when they adopt, and they plan to keep the pet around for many Easters to come. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.